You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tig Enright, and Georgina Godwin.
The world is in mourning after the passing of anti-apartheid revolutionary and political icon Nelson Mandela.
Fellow South Africans, our beloved Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, the founding president of our democratic nation, has departed.
His successor to the South African presidency, Jacob Zuma, there. We'll take a look back on his life and assess his legacy.
Also ahead, as footballing nations wait to learn who'll face each other in next year's World Cup, we introduce you to the 12 different Brazilian cities who will host the event. Some you've probably never heard of.
You know, in Brazil we have this kind of problem with violence and everything, but Natal is constantly on the top as one of the safest capitals in Brazil
It's quite poor, but quite safe.
We also speak to our correspondent in Paris, get a roundup of today's Nordic papers, and play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, Bill Bingham has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. South Africans have been gathering in Johannesburg and Soweto to mourn their former leader, Nelson Mandela, who died on Thursday, aged 95. Crowds have been paying tribute, some draped in South African flags and wearing the shirts of the governing African National Congress, dancing and singing in front of Mr. Mandela's former home in Soweto throughout the night. Flags are flying at half-mast after President Jacob Zuma announced his death in a late-night speech on national TV.
This is the moment of our deepest sorrow. Our nation has lost its greatest son. Yet, what made Nelson Mandela great was precisely what made him human. We saw in him what we seek in ourselves.
Nelson Mandela was South Africa's first black president. He led the country's transition from white minority rule in the 1990s after being held for 27 years in prison for his political activities. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993, an honor he shared with F.W. de Klerk, the white Afrikaner leader who released Mr. Mandela from jail. U.S. President Barack Obama was one of the first world leaders to pay public tribute. He said Mr. Mandela's legacy will never fade.
Through his fierce dignity and unbending will to sacrifice his own freedom for the freedom of others, Madiba transformed South Africa and moved all of us. His journey from a prisoner to a president embodied the promise that human beings and countries can change for the better.
Some South Africans say they fear the anti-apartheid hero's death could once again leave their country vulnerable to racial and social tension. These Soweto residents hope Mr. Mandela's example will continue to pacify extremist views.
It's a sad day in South Africa, I must say. We've lost a great role model, we've really. But I think the greatest thing is that at least his legacy, you know, will live on.
He spent 27 years in prison just to give to the people of South Africa what freedom means.
So it's a pretty sad day. I mean, we're lucky to be in an era where there's been such a great man who had so much forgiveness and compassion and able to get over things.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called on everyone to learn the wisdom, determination and commitment of Mr. Mandela to make this world better for all. In other news, a huge storm has hit northern Europe, leaving at least three people dead and causing extensive transport disruption. A lorry driver was killed when his vehicle was blown over in Scotland, and a man died when he was hit by a falling tree in England. In Denmark, a woman was killed when a lorry was overturned in high winds. Experts fear there'll be the biggest tidal surge in decades. In Germany, the port of Hamburg is being prepared for a direct hit. More than 300 people died there in a similar surge in 1962. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is meeting South Korean leader Park Geun-hye on the third leg of an Asian tour dominated by tensions over China's newly declared air defense zone. Ms. Park will brief Mr. Biden on South Korea's possible proposal to expand its own zone, which the United States is expected to oppose. China's air defense zone covers islands controlled by Japan and an area claimed by Seoul. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill. It's 10.05 in Johannesburg, 17.05 in Tokyo and 8.05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. He taught a divided nation to come together, the words of Archbishop Desmond Tutu after the passing of Nelson Mandela. Now South Africa must learn to live without its great father, who gave up so much of his life so his brethren could live as equals.
Mandela will go down in history as one of its greatest revolutionaries and statesmen. A little later we'll be assessing his legacy with Zinia Dormandy, the project director for the US at Chatham House in London, James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press, and Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor. Welcome to the programme, all of you.
Welcome, thank you.
But leaders from around the world have also been paying tribute to this political icon, the former South African president, F.W. de Klerk, who hastened the end of apartheid by finally releasing Mr. Mandela from jail, and who also shared a Nobel Peace Prize with him, said, "It was with the greatest sadness that I've learned of the death of Nelson Mandela. He lived reconciliation. He was a great unifier." Here too is the US President Barack Obama.
He achieved more than could be expected of any man. And today he's gone home. And we've lost one of the most influential, courageous, and profoundly good human beings that any of us will share time with on this earth. He no longer belongs to us. He belongs to the ages.
U.S. civil rights leader Jesse Jackson said Mandela was a global force for good with his suffering and his vision. He chose, at a critical moment, reconciliation over retribution. Here's Burma's democracy campaigner who herself spent 15 years under house arrest, Aung San Suu Kyi.
He made us all understand that nobody should be penalized for the color of his skin, for the circumstances into which he is born. He also made us understand that we can change the world. We can change the world by changing attitudes, by changing perceptions. For this reason, I would like to pay him tribute as a great human being who raised the standard of humanity.
Aung San Suu Kyi there. Now our long-time South Africa correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith, reflects on his and his country's long walk to freedom.
The great-great-grandson of a Xhosa king, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, was born on the 18th of July 1918 in rural Mvezu in the Eastern Cape. Dutch settlers had occupied the Cape for nearly 300 years, but it was when British colonisation began in 1806 that laws limiting the freedom of indigenous people were introduced. Mandela often told the story of how, when he was eight, his father, a chief, stood up to a local magistrate over a stray ox. He refused to accept the white man's jurisdiction and was humiliatingly relieved of his duties. When Mandela was nine, his father died and he was taken in by Chief Jogintama Dalindyebo. At the royal court, he witnessed government in grassroots form, where no decision was taken until everyone had spoken. It was a formative experience. The late opposition politician Helen Suzman.
What struck me particularly, both on Robben Island and Pearlsmoor, was that Nelson Mandela has undoubtedly got the respect of the people in whose charge he is. That, I think, says a lot for the man. They're very respectful when they talk to him, and he's very polite when he talks to them.
Mandela's royal breeding sheltered him from white oppression and gave him access to the best education available to black South Africans. His student encounters at the universities of Fort Hare and Witwatersrand included future leaders of the Communist Party and African National Congress. In 1952, he opened a legal practice in partnership with Oliver Tambo, the future head of the ANC. In 1944, at the age of 26, Mandela had married Evelyn Maze. They'd had two children, but he found much more of a soulmate in the militant social worker, Nomzamo Zaniwe Winifred Madikizela. He married Winnie in 1958. By then, Mandela was well known to the authorities for organising demonstrations against the pass laws, legislation that meant black South Africans could not move freely around the country. By the early 1960s, he and the rest of the leadership were moving away from the idea of passive resistance to apartheid. His first conviction for incitement came after an arrest in 1962, but it was his second arrest, along with seven other activists, that led to the Rivonia trial under the Suppression of Communism and Sabotage Act. Mandela's first words as he stood in the dock on the 3rd of December 1963 were, "The government should be in the dock, not me. I plead not guilty." On the 13th of July 1964, Mandela was shipped to Robben Island off Cape Town, where he was to spend most of the next 26 years.
Our clothing was a short pair of trousers and a khaki shirt, and then open-toed sandals. And our work was to crush stones, and it was so cold that you felt it in your bones.
The isolation of Robben Island was painful. When Mandela's son Tembi died, he wasn't allowed to attend his funeral. Several escape scenarios were dreamt up by the ANC, a helicopter airlift and a getaway car waiting outside a Cape Town dentist's. But the authorities got wind of the plans and they were never attempted. Winnie Mandela, who was involved in underground activity, was jailed repeatedly and eventually banished to a remote town. She was allowed to visit Mandela once on Robben Island for 30 minutes in 1970. In the 1980s, the Free Mandela campaign gathered steam, and the world was changing. With the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, those in the West who'd tolerated the apartheid regime because it was anti-communist no longer had an argument. Mandela was released from Victor Verster prison near Cape Town on the 11th of February 1990. He made his first public speech from the balcony of Cape Town's Old Town Hall.
Friends, comrades, I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy and freedom for all. Your tireless and heroic sacrifices have made it possible for me to be here today. I therefore place the remaining years of my life in your hands.
4 years of negotiations followed before South Africa was ready for its first all-race elections and its first black president. In that time, crafting his global image as a reconciler, Mandela shed the shrill company of Winnie and charmed the country's white business leaders into not pulling out of South Africa. It was an amazing achievement. Having voted in a general election for the first time as a 75-year-old, Nelson Mandela was sworn in as president on the 10th of May 1994.
The time for the healing of the wounds has come. We enter into a covenant that we shall build a society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall, a rainbow nation, at peace with itself and the world.
During Mandela's single 5-year term, he left the day-to-day running of South Africa to his deputy, Thabo Mbeki. But his image as a symbol of forgiveness loomed over the country as it organised a public reconciliation process under Archbishop Desmond Tutu and wrote the most progressive constitution in the world. In 1998, at the age of 80, he married Graça Machel, the widow of Mozambican liberation leader Samora Machel. There's no gainsaying Mandela's global image as an icon. We'd like all our politicians to aspire to Mandela's status and integrity. But South Africa, still one of the most economically unequal societies in the world, has a more complex relationship with his legacy. The ANC has become a power-hungry bully, guided by populism and cronyism. There's a South African saying that goes, where a big tree once stood, new trees struggle to grow. It seems to be true for Nelson Mandela.
And that's Alex Duval-Smith, our longtime South Africa correspondent. Well, returning to our studio guests, Xenia Dormandy of Chatham House, James Schneider from Think Africa Press, and our own foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve, what do you believe Mandela's greatest legacy will be?
I think Alex's final words there summed up his legacy rather well. It's important to remember today, and please don't take this the wrong way, that Nelson Mandela was not a saint. He was a human being who had his faults, who some would say perhaps wasn't as great a president as he was a liberation leader. But his greatest legacy, if we choose to learn from it, will be the art of forgiveness, that ability to, not just in terms of striking a peace deal with the very political regime that had incarcerated him and his people, but then after that, when he was president, say, I'm president for all South Africans, for the Rainbow Nation, whether you are black, white, or whatever your upbringing, I am your president, and I will, and we will be a true democracy. Whether we're looking at Afghanistan, whether we're looking at Colombia with the FARC peace talks that are happening there, that ability to forgive, or at least publicly forgive, even if perhaps in your heart you can't, is an incredibly important lesson that, frankly, most of us aren't able to do, and that is obviously why we hold him up on this pedestal.
James,
I think perhaps his biggest legacy is that he proves that the seemingly impossible can happen. I think if you asked most people in 1980 or 1985 or 1989, do you think by 1994 Nelson Mandela will be president? They would have said no. I think if you asked him, he would have said no, of course not. And I think his whole life and his struggle acts as a sort of reminder to anybody who's engaging now in political or social struggle, that really quite radical transformation can happen.
And Xenia, what do you think?
I just add a quick word to James, which is can happen, and can happen relatively peacefully. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to take one message from his liberation political career, it's that you can have transformative change in a way that doesn't mean one side loses everything.
And how much of a model of that do you think it is for other kind of conflicts all over the world?
Well, I mean, what we do know, and this kind of harks back to what Steve was saying, you need real leadership. I mean, you do need somebody that can induce, persuade others to follow and choose a path that is, no question, far harder than the path of violence, the path of my way or the highway. And that's what he did.
Now, of course, this has affected all of us hugely all over the world, but in South Africa particularly, that there are huge reactions to this. So just before we came on air, I spoke to Peter Thornycroft, who is the Daily Telegraph correspondent based in Johannesburg. She told me she'd been up all night talking about this and reacting with people. Let's hear what she said.
The sorrow is more muted than the South African energy and celebration of his life. That is what I was so astonished last night at after the news broke from President Jacob Zuma. I don't live far from Mandela, and I went around his house and joined throngs of people. And it looked like the South Africa Mandela must have dreamt of in long years in prison, because they were blacks, they were whites, they were South Africans of Indian origin, Tamils, Muslims, Jews, every shape, size, age, description of person you could imagine, particularly, of course, a large number of whites, because a large number of whites live around there. And I was surprised that the sort of the 30 to 40-year-old whites whose parents may have had a different memory of Mandela to their generation who just missed having to go to war. They were all there, some of them looking a bit sleepy. A couple have come from restaurants, have had a couple of glasses of wine. And what was then extraordinary was a sort of a sudden moment of God knows what happened, but that hundreds of them moved towards the house within the police cordon and suddenly started singing the anthem and Kosi Sikelel' Afrika. And it was literally electrifying under the huge old trees parked about a century ago in these old Joburg streets. Houghton is a city of great old mansions. It's the old part of Johannesburg, and the trees along those streets were planted. They're English trees, really. This was long before indigenous trees became fashionable. So it's a very, in fact, English-looking street. And the police were quite quiet. The cars were parked for miles around. And as I left at sort of 1:30 in the morning, there were still cars coming in. Wherever people had heard the news late at night, they were coming. And I got back and started writing, as I write for the Daily Telegraph. And I turned on my radio to a local radio station, Radio 702. And I could not stop listening because ordinary people were phoning in with their memories. And it struck me as I listened how many people Mandela met in his years of freedom. How many of them, ordinary people, professional people, important people. But gosh, it never stopped with people's memories. It's still going on as we speak. People are phoning in with their memories all day. This will go on, I'm sure, during this whole period. It will be a week of memories.
Peter Thornycroft there in Johannesburg speaking to Georgina a little earlier. Steve, we've heard so many tributes paid, not just by members of the public and South Africans, but world leaders. But I wonder, was he really so universally revered?
Well, exactly. And this is the thing. Every world leader worth his salt will have been forcing their way in front of a microphone in the last 12 hours to give their memories of Nelson Mandela and say what a great man he was. But this was not always the case. Part of the reason why the struggle was so hard was because major world leaders were very much in favour of apartheid, or at the very least were opposed to helping the anti-apartheid forces and groups. So here in the UK, you had Margaret Thatcher, who supported the apartheid government in South Africa. She said that Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. The young Conservatives, the youth group of the Conservative Party, many of whom are now MPs, had badges and T-shirts which said "Hang Nelson Mandela." Ronald Reagan was not a fan either. And again, to bring it forward, this is one of the lessons that I hope people learn from it. We often say our enemy's enemy is a friend, but often we always assume that enemies' friends must also be enemies. Because the ANC were supported by the Soviet Union, because the Communist Party was a large part of the ANC and the anti-apartheid movement, a lot of leaders in the West saw the ANC as the enemy because they were with the Soviets. And if there's one lesson for world leaders now, it's to ensure that just because someone you've put them in a category of they're our enemy, doesn't mean that they are.
James, what impact do you think is South Africa ready for this? How will it cope? Because it's not just about the mourning of a great leader. It's a mourning of a unifier and somebody who is holding together a nation which at times appears about to fall apart.
I don't think a country can ever be ready for, even though they've known he's been ill for a very long time, the death of somebody who's so revered, who's such an important part of the national narrative for all, in different ways for different types of people and for different people. And I think that we don't quite know how the country will really react and how it's prepared for that. And I don't think you can ever really be fully prepared for when such a large icon gets removed from your constellation.
Zenia, do you think that it might be true to say that his real legacy was not to launch a personality cult and to move aside, to just do one term, rather like George Washington in the early days, and to move aside? And that's a legacy not only to South Africa, but to the rest of Africa, to show how this might be achieved.
Yes, I mean, we can point to 5, 10 different examples where he did something that was unexpected, that frankly nobody or few people thought was possible, and he did it in a different way that had a different result. I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about Pakistan and Afghanistan today. And we have a, or Syria, we have a scenario, we think we know what that looks like, we think we know how that plays out. And I think what individuals like Nelson Mandela tell you is that nothing is guaranteed, that some things that are so unbelievable are possible if you have the right leadership in the right circumstances. Somebody can see their way through. And this is, again, not to say that he was a perfect individual. As Steve said, he wasn't a saint, but he found paths that others didn't find. And there is a message in that, not just for Africa, but for the world writ large.
And I mean, what part do you think, or how big a part did he play in the global fight against racism? I mean, I just wonder, would there be a President Barack Obama today were it not for President Nelson Mandela?
Well, so I saw The Butler last night, and I will not make any comments about whether The Butler is worth going to the movies for, but there is no question, and you know, we've heard President Obama's words. Many people will remember he went to South Africa. He was going to visit with Nelson Mandela earlier this year, and he's called him an important figure in his history, an important leader that he's followed, an important role model. That's a personal statement. Whether Obama could be president of the United States had there not been. You can make an argument, certainly, that if Nelson Mandela hadn't been able to turn around, or if the apartheid movement hadn't been able to turn around when it did, the world writ large, I mean, that was, you know, one step, one milestone in a change in the way people think. So, yes, arguably.
I just want to go back to that period between 1990 and 1994, because it's often passed over quite quickly that, well, Nelson Mandela was, you know, released in 1990, and anyone who, you know, who saw that moment when it happened will still remember exactly where they were. I still remember sort of, you know, sitting in my living room watching it on TV and my mum shouting, "Oh, it's happening," and we watched him come out. And then you think of the election in 1994 and all those, you know, enormous, you know, queues of people queuing for vote. But there was this incredibly important period in those 4 years in between when, you know, as James was saying, there was this very real threat of civil war, that was the white establishment going to accept majority black rule? Were white militias, and there were white militia groups, far-right white groups that were talking about this.
And I think that a lot of his reconciliation, the way in which he dealt with the white, both political and business establishment, and also the only doing one term, really needs to be viewed in the context of the very, very real threat of violence, the very real threat that the then established elite would not accept transition and would not accept black rule, even if they still had significant control over the security forces and the economy.
We're a long way, though, James, aren't we, from the kind of utopian nation, or even close to utopian nation, which Nelson Mandela would have dreamed of building.
Yes, and that's another thing which we tend to forget in the Mandela victory story, is that the end of apartheid wasn't that the ANC won, it was that it was a negotiated end between both sides, between both the apartheid government and the largest economic forces and the ANC on the other hand. And so really we're still seeing that legacy borne out in South Africa's economy and South Africa's society, because it's not as if majority rule in all sectors of South African society suddenly became the norm. It only became for the political leadership.
If I can just pick up on that, I mean, we have to remember there's at least two parts to this. There's the actions, and then there's the way people think. And I just wanted to pick up, I mean, I was in South Africa in 91, and, you know, talking to a lot of white South Africans, they knew things had to change, but they still would look at the black community in a kind of pejorative sense. It'd be interesting, you know, is that still the case today? You can change the way the structures, you can put in a black government, you can put in black business leaders, But actually, how do people still think?
And let's pick up on that and just round off this discussion by looking at the future. Now that Mandela's dead is how many sentences will start in South Africa for the next few months. And of course, he hasn't been physically in charge for a long time now. But the mere fact of his existence, people have said, has kept a lid on things. There are all sorts of young Turks in the background. Julius Malema is one of them. Do you think that suddenly, Steve, there will be perhaps an explosion of violence, or that we will see radical political change now that Mandela is no longer alive?
No, I think this was often talked about before Mandela became president. There were some who'd say, oh, well, you know, once those guys get in charge, everything's going to change. And then it was, well, look, when Mandela steps down in 1999, when he's off the political scene, that's when the gloves will come off and they'll show their true colours. And then, of course, the final thing was, oh, well, look, when he dies, then it's all going to change. South Africa, you know, changes in the way that all new democracies change. And there are figures like Julius Malema, who you mentioned, who's something of a firebrand on the on the populist left. I think it's, you know, the idea that people like him were perhaps being kept in check because Mandela was still alive, I don't quite buy. I think it's a democracy that is evolving. The important thing will be that I'm interested to see over the next 5-10 years is whether, with Mandela going, there will be the possibility that a successor party to the ANC might emerge that is willing to actually take on what has become the new establishment.
Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, Xenia Dormady, project director for the US at Chatham House, and James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Thank you all very much for coming in to talk to us.
Pleasure. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll be leafing through today's Nordic papers. We'll be speaking to our man in Paris, and we'll introduce you to some of the Brazilian cities hosting the World Cup next year. Now, you may never have heard of them, and I may never be able to pronounce them.
First, though, Bill Bingham has the world news headlines.
South Africans have been gathering in Johannesburg and Soweto to mourn their former leader, Nelson Mandela, who died on Thursday, aged 95. He'd been suffering from a lung illness for a long time and had been receiving treatment at home since September, when he was discharged from hospital. Nelson Mandela was South Africa's first black president. He led the country's transition from white minority rule in the 1990s after being held for 27 years in prison for his political activities. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993, an honour he shared with F.W. de Klerk, the white Afrikaner leader who released Mr. Mandela from jail. Crowds have been paying tribute, some draped in South African flags and wearing the shirts of the governing African National Congress, dancing and singing in front of Mr. Mandela's former home in Soweto throughout the night. Flags are flying at half-mast after President Jacob Zuma announced his death in a late-night speech on national television. World leaders have been paying tribute. US President Barack Obama was one of the first. He said Mr. Mandela's legacy will never fade. Kofi Annan, the chairman of the Elders, a group of global leaders set up by Mr. Mandela to pursue peace and human rights, said the world had lost a clear moral compass. In Australia, former Prime Minister Bob Hawke hailed Nelson Mandela as a great statesman and champion of freedom, saying he was so huge a personality that he was able to forgive those who treated him so abominably. One other story, a huge storm has hit northern Europe, leaving at least 3 people dead and causing extensive transport disruption. Experts fear there'll be the biggest tidal surge in decades. In Germany, the port of Hamburg is being prepared for a direct hit. More than 300 people died there in a similar surge in 1962. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It is 8:34 here in London and 9:34 in Paris, and that's where we're going to next. Monocle's correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson joins us on the phone. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Tom.
Well, it's all been about South Africa here in London and indeed all over the world. Tell us, what's been the reaction in Paris to the passing of Nelson Mandela?
Well, a great sense of sadness, perhaps not shock as this had been expected, as everyone knows, but the newspapers, a lot of them didn't quite manage to get this on the front page because, in fact, the news fell quite close to sort of deadline time for newspapers to submit their front covers. And nevertheless, it is the top story on Le Figaro this morning, the right-leaning newspaper saying Nelson Mandela, a man of peace, has died. Libération leading with that top story as well. They've got a picture of Nelson Mandela saying, the man who made apartheid fall. The French president, François Hollande, has issued a statement as well expressing his sadness. He says, Mandela's message will never die. It will continue to inspire freedom fighters and give confidence to people who defend just causes and universal rights. Lots of sadness here because Mandela, even since the mid-1980s, people here in France have been following him very closely. There were huge protests outside Notre Dame in the mid-1980s calling for his release from prison. And so perhaps it was that sense of solidarity that inspired him to visit Paris just 3 months after being released from prison. He came here and there was a huge reception for him at the Trocadéro Palace, just in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower. And over the years, Mandela came to Paris frequently. He was the guest of honor at the Bastille Day celebrations in 1996. Again, he came back to Paris where he met President Jacques Chirac in 2000 and was always given a rapturous welcome, especially because he came very often campaigning for important causes such as AIDS awareness. So very much a sad day, and this is absolutely dominating the news here in France today.
And of course, there are 40 African leaders in town today and tomorrow for this big France-Africa Congress.
That's right. That meeting officially gets underway today and goes on into the weekend. Lots of interest in the African continent around the world. I mean, China very much present in that continent, and I think France feels that by hosting summits like this one in Paris, it could win back some influence and sort of try to reassert itself a little bit more. And before that summit even got underway, the French president was announcing plans to double aid and trade with the continent over the next 5 years. But what's really dominating discussion, of course, there will be a great sense of sadness overshadowing that summit now. But the situation in the Central African Republic is getting out of control. The country's Muslims and Christians are engaged in deadly sectarian violence. And France has now decided for the second time in a year to deploy troops to a country in Africa. Of course, they deployed troops to Mali back in January. And some would say Operation Serval in Mali hasn't even finished. So to send troops for the second time in a year to a former colony in Africa is going to take some people by surprise here. But the situation there is out of control. The country actually, for the second time, France has been asked by the country in question to send troops. And I think this is part of France's mission, which is to be Africa's policeman, the gendarme of Africa, to try to help bring about stability in areas of turmoil and chaos.
Tom, looking at some issues closer to home now, and French parliamentarians about to vote on a change in the way the law regards prostitution.
Yes, this was last week's and the beginning of this week's absolutely front page news story, because that vote in the lower house was in favour of changing the laws on prostitution. It was passed by a wide majority, and it basically, if it becomes law, it will make France one of the most restrictive countries in Europe when it comes to prostitution. And the difference between this law and other laws is that the act of soliciting will no longer be punished, but clients of prostitutes face a €1,500 fine if caught, and they will pay double that if they're caught again. In fact, some people are angry about this law, in particular sex workers' unions, who are saying that this is going to force prostitution further underground, put them at greater risk, and of course, deprive them of their livelihood. But I think other people are very vocal on this point, saying that this will put a stop to human trafficking and violence against women, because after all, 90%, it's estimated, of France's prostitutes actually work for trafficking networks, namely, principally those from Nigeria, China and Romania. Well, that law hasn't yet been signed. It goes to the Senate next week, and if it passes, then yes, it does become law.
Tom Burgess Watson, our correspondent in Paris, thank you very much for joining us.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a guide to Brazilian World Cup cities.
This Christmas, gather up your elves, load up the sleigh and head to Midori House for our annual Christmas fair. We'll be hosting our favourite nations and retailers, mixing up Swiss Weihnachten and Japanese Kurisumasu with traditional Yuletide cheer. You can stock up on Christmas presents for your loved ones, pet our reindeer, enjoy performances from our musical guests. You can even meet our Finnish VIP, Santa Claus. It's all happening at Midori House at 1 Dorset Street from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. on the 7th and 8th of December.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:40 here in London. Did you hear that reindeer?
I thought it was a bit strange, actually. who let the horse out? I thought, but there you go.
You've got to come there. You've got to come to the Christmas
I'll
market.
Be there. I'll be there with bells. What do you call it? Sleigh bells on.
Sleigh bells on, of course. Now let's talk about football, because in the resort town Costa do Salpe in Brazil, today's focus will be less on Caipirinhas and Samba and more on the World Cup draw, in which competing nations will learn just who they're competing against. The teams and matches will be allocated to the 12 different Brazilian cities who'll host the event.
From big cities such as Sao Paulo and Rio to less well-known towns such as Natal, Brazil sometimes seems like more like a continent due to its sheer size. Well, our producer Alan John spoke to our in-house favourite Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who took us on a tour of Brazil's hidden gems. In this first part, he takes us to the Amazon and to the scenic seaside capitals of the Northeast.
Let's start with Manaus then, which actually Manaus is kind of, for me at least, is the most exotic city of the north, because, you know, I'm originally from São Paulo. Just for me to go there, I have to take a plane. It takes 5 hours.
It's near the Amazon. It's in the Amazon, isn't
it? It's in the middle of the jungle. Of course, it's a very kind of, I mean, they have 2 million people living there. So there's actually people living there, you know. But, you know, it's just a throwaway. You can go to, I mean, the jungle is not far away at all, you know. So you can see all those, the famous animals in the Amazon and everything. But it's not all nature, you know. There's a lot of culture as well.
Okay.
In fact, there is a place very famous, the Teatro Amazonas, which was made in the late 19th century, and it brought like all the material from Europe. So it's a very kind of chic and elegant.
So you have a real cultural mix, kind of colonial architecture, perhaps a mix of that and the new.
Exactly, and I have to say, food wise. I mean, they have fresh, of course, fresh fish and amazing fruits. I mean, if you see their fruit stands, it's just incredible. It's like a rainbow, you know. There's any sort of colors and shapes that you could possibly imagine.
Mm.
And, well, as you know, Alex, for each city, I'm going to introduce you a song.
Yes, let's hear a little flavor of the sort of music that you might be able to hear in Manaus.
She looks like a rainbow as well. So this is the lovely, she's self-called the Amazonian queen.
This is very apt.
Exactly. This is Gabi Amarantos with Shirley.
Saia vermelha, camisa preta, chegou pra abalar. Quando tu for na casa dela lhe buscar, ela vai preparar café coado na calcinha, só pra lhe enfeitiçar.
It's pretty lively.
Very lively.
She's... Describe that kind of music to me. I'm a musician, but for those who aren't listening, tell me about it.
It's a new Brazilian style, actually. It's from the north of Brazil. It's called Tecno Brega, which
Techno.
Techno, because, you know, she does use some techno beats, but...
It's not the techno I'm familiar with, but I like
it. It's a new Brazilian twist on the techno, you know, so... And the clothes she wears is just amazing, you know. Actually, the cover of her album, she's wearing, like, some sort of bra with lasers on it, you know.
And kind of Madonna style.
Exactly, but there's like, a Black Panther on the cover as well, and she's great.
Cool, Moving on, where are we heading to next? We're heading north, northeast.
Northeast, and actually it's a city that I'm very familiar with because I lived there for a year and a half.
Natal,
and actually is the most northern city in Brazil, so is very close to Europe, in fact.
Also very warm then, very Amazonian kind of climate, really sticky, the sort of thing that the English football team will not be looking forward to.
Yeah, but come on, they have such scenic beaches. Actually, I think they will look forward. I think, actually, if I would be from the English scene, I would prefer to be there than in São Paulo. It would be more exotic, more interesting.
True, true. But, and you know, in terms of the climate, it's not going to let the climate's not going to lend itself to an acclimatized English football performance. But you're right. Maybe after the match, they can kick back on the beaches.
And it's well known in Brazil as the city of sun, because more than 300 days a year, the city is extremely sunny and is a very relaxing city. And that's the interesting thing, because comparing to other northeastern cities like Salvador, Recife, which are much bigger and more important culturally, but Natal is very peaceful. And actually, you know, in Brazil, we have this kind of problem with violence and everything. Mm. But Natal is constantly on the top as one of the safest capitals in Brazil
It's quite poor, but quite safe.
Poor and safe. So it's funny, this link as well, because not necessarily the poorest cities are the most violent ones as well. And the people there, they even have a slow way of talking. It's charming, I think.
Your accent isn't from Natal then. You lived there for a while, but you speak Brazilian with a São Paulo accent. Right?
With São Paulo accent. But, you know, if you leave me there like for another 2 years, probably I'll be talking.
Can you give me a little taste of what it's like, the accent?
Of course. For example, in São Paulo, I'll say my name with my accent, Fernando. You know, very almost
wait,
strict.
Fernando.
But then Natal is like, Fernando. Can you feel the
difference?
Fernando. You know, it's lovely. It's very musical as well.
It's lovely. It is lovely. So speaking of musical, we have another little taste of what Natal might offer us if we were to, say, hit a bar or a club of an evening.
After the Amazonian Queen, now it's something more calmer, but still lovely. It's Roberta Sá, one of the new upcoming Brazilian singers. And this is Samba de Amor e Ódio, or the Samba of Love and Hate.
Na laranjeira, veja lá, não vá subir na laranjeira, veja lá, se você cair do galho, eu não vou lhe levantar. Não vá subir na laranjeira, veja lá, não vá subir na laranjeira, veja lá, se você cair do galho, eu não vou lhe levantar.
More traditional, something I'm much more familiar with, I'd say, as a fan of Brazilian music. What is it? It's not merengue, it's not... It's samba. What?
It's pure samba.
It's pure samba,
You can feel the beat right at the beginning, right? I saw you're almost dancing out of there. I can see that, you know?
Hey, it's radio. People aren't allowed to hear that.
Sorry.
Cool. So, that's Natal. Moving on, where are we heading?
Well, we're still in the northeast of Brazil, but a very different city from Natal is Recife.
Recife,
which
okay.
is much bigger as well. They have like 2.4 million people living
more
there.
More industrial, much more commerce.
Exactly. They still have amazing beaches, you know, great food as well. But what is interesting about Recife is one of the fastest growing states in Brazil. And actually, the governor of the state of Pernambuco, where Recife is the capital, Eduardo Campos, is a pre-candidate for next year's presidential elections. So even the city is very important for Brazilian politics. And also interesting, the rich cultural life in the city. And one thing that I would like to say, actually, there's a lot of interesting films coming from directors from there. And one that comes to mind is Kleber Mendonça Filho, who directed a film called Neighboring Sounds, which is the Brazilian choice for the best foreign language film in next year's Oscars. It's a great film. I've seen it. It's about an apartment block in Recife, and it described the life of the middle class in the city.
Can you give us an idea of what the life of the middle class is like in a city like Recife?
Well, as you probably imagine, Brazil changed a lot in the last 10 years. So usually the northeast of Brazil was the poorest region in the country. Recife, because it's a bigger city, they had a more kind of solid middle class, but now even more so. So, of course, there's still the terrible inequality, in the whole of Brazil, but Recife is getting much richer now.
Rich and culturally as well.
Rich culture, but they've always been very rich culturally. And they have, you know, even in Carnival, which is around February, March, they have their own special Carnival, which is Frevo, which people, they dress different. So it's complete. If you go to Carnival in Recife, it's not the one you're used to in Rio.
How is it different? It doesn't have bikini clad women and men in pants dancing down the streets.
You're right. You got it.
It doesn't have them.
Well, of course it does. I mean, we're on the beach, but there is like a more cultural background, I would say.
Oh, okay.
I hope the real listeners are not listening to me right now. But
well, let's hear some of the music that they might offer us in Recife.
And that's actually a rock band called Nação Zumbi. They even created a new rhythm called Mangue Beat, and which was very influential in the 90s in Brazil. And the name of the song is Maracatu Atômico.
Manamawe. Manamawe, awea, 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 awea,
So that's a new kind of music in Brazil, is it?
Yeah, well, as I said, it was very influential in the 90s. So I do, this song is from the 90s, actually.
But okay.
It's still very influential today. And Chico Science, which was the vocalist of the band, unfortunately died, you know. And he was considered one of the best musicians in Brazil. And I think people are still very sorry for that. But he created a new generation of great singers as well from Recife.
And that was our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, giving us the first part of the tour among the less well-known Brazilian cities that will be hosting the World Cup next year. And the second and final part of that tour will be played on the station later today.
Now, in a moment, we're going to be taking a leaf through the newspapers with a Nordic bent. But first, a little bit of music for you from Sweden's Lykke Li. This is I Follow Rivers.
And that's the Swedish artist Lykke Li with I Follow Rivers. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Tig Enright. And we continue today's with today's Nordic Papers. Joining us in the studio is Monocle's Marcus Hippie.
Hello, good morning. I have to say, you know, I happened to watch the music video for that song we just heard last night for whatever reason.
As you do.
It's a very weird video. There's some woman chasing a man in somewhere in Swedish thunder, it seems like. It's snowing, it's really cold, and she's just chasing him. And finally she catches him. He starts crying, and then they hug, and then they kiss.
What
that's
are they
like
wearing?
That's like a Nordic mating ritual.
Are they really stylish?
They're not. They're wearing black.
Black?
Well, actually, Nordic.
Well, that's kind of stylish. Kind of like, yeah. What do you say? Georgina's wearing mostly black today. You're trying to say that's not stylish?
I think it sounds fabulous and it's a great song. Marcus, first of all, let me congratulate you. Happy Finnish Independence Day.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been quite a few years already of Finnish independence. We don't need to wait that long, you know. In a few years, Finland is going to turn 100 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh, it's
just like Ireland.
Time has.
My home.
Really? It's also 100 years independent?
Well, since the, really? Yeah, since the rising, the Easter Rising, which finally sent the British packing.
Right. Yes. I think we'll move back to the Nordic region.
Yeah, let's do that. Sorry for that.
There is a tradition in Finland that every Independence Day, the president organises an Independence Day reception. And what's exceptional this year is that for the first time, it is not happening in the capital. It's actually happening in Tampere, which has got a reputation. It's one of the bigger cities in Finland. It's got a reputation of being very working class. And it's kind of interesting. It came as a surprise. On the background, there is a practical reason. The president's castle is under renovation, so they had to find another place, but they decided to take it outside of the capital, which in this case equals to say in the UK the Queen organising something in Manchester or President Obama organising something
in Detroit
instead of Washington DC. So people are kind of excited about that, but at the same time I feel like they're slightly confused, in particular because this new venue for this party that normally has included a lot of dancing takes place in a congress centre.
But is there a little bit of disillusionment maybe in Finland that things are too centralised in the capital? I mean, will it be welcomed for that, reason?
I think that's one of the reasons, and also I think it's got something to do with the financial struggle Finland is facing at the moment. So, you know, they're kind of like they are making it less grandeur this time, so there's not that much punch available, supposedly not that much to drink, and they have been inviting more people who don't belong to the traditional elite of Finland, so they're more, you know.
So the year that they don't invite the elite, they tone down the party. It's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree in that point. But still, there's a lot of accusations that the whole Independence Day celebration organised by the president is very elitist. And once again, the police officers are getting prepared for demonstrations around that place where this party is taking place. It's been quite quiet during the last years, but it was about 10 years ago when there was quite a lot of violence, actually. There were a lot of young activists outside of the president's castle kind of greeting people arriving to the party. I think they were throwing eggs at them and so on. So after that year, the police forces are always there present just to make sure that nothing similar happens again.
But there'll be lots of parties. We know that you're having a party here in London. You're going to
What's
be
a Finnish Independence
champagne.
Day party like it in your house?
In my actually, I'm not going
Can
to my
come?
House.
Oh, you're
I'm,
off to the embassy,
I'm
aren't go, you?
No, I'm going to the ambassador's residence.
Oh, with
for
a Ferrero Rocher.
Sparkling. So if you saw me a few hours later, I would be wearing my suit already. So yeah, it's nice that embassies are organising similar stuff abroad as well. So, you know, Finnish communities, there are quite a few Finns living in London actually. So
And is there a good sort of sense of community amongst Finns abroad?
There is, absolutely there is. I think because Finland is such a small country, and even more so when you are not in your home country, you kind of feel more patriotic and you want to be more involved.
We were trying to get you to sing the national anthem earlier.
Ah, this is like the great moment of embarrassing myself because I'm not quite sure of the lyrics. Anyway, let's to move
but
on to another.
That's clearly because you haven't been educated properly, and nor okay, have your fellow Finns.
The ambassador's not listening.
Talking about education, yes. Finland has got a great reputation due to its education system, but it seems that things are not going that well now. The results of the recent PISA survey show that Finland has dropped on the list, and well,
from where to where?
A few.
You're now, I think, 12th best in the world for maths, and
exactly.
You were considerably higher than
we
that
used to
before.
Be so much higher. I don't remember the precise numbers, but yeah. we used to be a lot better, and now it's
I
the
know,
moment
I know
the, for
I know there are no medals for 12th, but you know, it's not bad.
It's the
Come
taking
on.
Part that counts.
Well it's interesting that Finland got massive. We had massive news in Finland after the results when we realized that we have dropped on the list, but actually we get equally big news now when there are claims that the Chinese would have cheated in this. That's kind of, you know,
that's
that
a
makes
bit sour
us,
grapey,
that makes
isn't
us
it?
Feel slightly better.
What's
you know,
the,
maybe
what's
we
the
were
Finnish
the
for sour grapes.
In Finnish,
or do you just call them grapes?
Grapes.
But I think one of the big points to take away from this is that that teaching is a very valued profession in Finland.
And Finnish teachers are extremely highly educated,
which is why it does so well. Actually, I mean, we're talking about it dropping, but actually, it's still I think overall sixth best or something. It's very, very good ranking, even though it's come down.
I want to squeeze in one more story because this is really important, and we're almost running out of time. If we go to Lapland, Rovaniemi and Pajakylä, there's Santa Claus land. And I'm just reading the news from that direction. There's a new exhibition over there that's just opened today. It's called Santa's House of Snowmobiles.
How cool is that?
How cool is that? Anyway, yeah. Santa won't be there because Santa will be in London tomorrow.
That's right. We could actually track his journey. He's on his way to London as we speak.
Absolutely fantastic stuff.
He's going to be joining the Christmas fair tomorrow.
That's true.
Check him out here at Midori House. But with that on Midori House, that's all we have time for today. Marcus Hippie, the man you've been hearing, it was actually our producer as well. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Bachaco and Luis Mendoza. Our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Up next after the news, Section D with Tom Morris. And Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. But for me, Ty Genright.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Have a great day.
Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.